This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Rob Heaton for New Books in Biblical Studies, where I focus on new and exciting scholarship in New Testament and Early Christian Studies, the orbit of my own PhD. I'm delighted to welcome Angela Kim Harkins as my guest today to discuss an early Christian text that is near and dear to my own heart, The Shepherd of Hermas, and or Hermas, if we were pronouncing it fully appropriately. I might say Hermas throughout this, though. But we'll look into her unique approach to the way that this text immerses readers into its strange visionary episodes. Let me introduce my guest first of all. Angela Kim Harkins earned her PhD from the University of Notre Dame in 2003 and is professor of New Testament at Boston College's School of Theology and Ministry. Her research interests have focused on prayer in Second Temple Judaism and early Christianity, including the Hodayot, or Thanksgiving hymns, from the Dead Sea Scrolls at Qumran. Among her eight publications in the last decade are edited volumes on The Fallen Angels and The Watchers, both of whom are known to us through apocryphal and pseudepigraphal texts. Angela was born in Seoul, South Korea, and presently serves as lead editor of the Journal of Ancient Judaism. And I've also learned on her website that she has a dog named Chloe Kim Barkin. So that's a wonderful little tidbit about our guest today. On top of all this, Angela is joining us from her home in the Boston area to discuss the publication of An Embodied Reading of the Shepherd of Hermas, the Book of Visions and its Role in Moral Formation. And it was published by Equinox Books last year, 2023. So Angela, it's my pleasure to welcome you to the New Books Network.
Okay, thank you so much, Rob. It's great to meet you and to be with you this morning.
Ah, absolutely. So first of all, it's wonderful to be speaking with you about your book, and especially exciting to see all the attention that is being given now to this obscure but very popular early Christian text known as The Shepherd, that we call now The Shepherd of Hermas. Your previous work has touched on Jewish literature mainly, both that we encounter in the Hebrew Bible and, or, you know, the Christian Old Testament, and other texts that are considered pseudepigraphal, with seemingly an interest in apocalyptic Jewish literature being high on your ladder there. How did you come to turn your attention to the shepherd and ultimately write this book? And for our listeners who may not be familiar with Hermas and his revelatory apparitions, can you give a brief overview of the shepherd and the place of the Book of Visions within it? And what stood out to you the most when you came to this text?
Okay, so I have known about the shepherd, and a lot of my work, as you said, has been mostly on Jewish and early Christian texts, mostly prayers and apocalypses, both of which are first person texts and use a lot of imagery. So early Jewish prayer texts actually is one of the larger categories or genres that we know about from the Dead Sea Scrolls. So it really increased our understanding of this particular an important type of writing. So I came to the shepherd largely through an interest in first person texts, visions, you might say, and also curiosity about apocalypses. I think too, the Shepherd of Hermas, when what's interesting when I would, and you mentioned that there's this growing interest and sort of renaissance of shepherd studies, which is exciting. As I was working on the Shepherd for a few years, when I would mention to scholars that this was a text that I've been looking at recently, I noticed a number of strong responses from people. And I don't know if you've also had that experience. You know, people either really love or hate the Shepherd. And that's really reflected too in the scholarship on the Shepherd. You know, modern scholars have had their own strong views on this particular work, oftentimes with the Shepherd sort of coming up short in those discussions. So
indeed, yes.
So I think I talk in my book about you know, Streeter, early sort of New Testament scholar who compares Hermas to the white rabbit in Alice in Wonderland. And so it's not a, it's sort of, he behaves in some unseemly ways. And I think for modern scholars, it's a little bit, it's an uncomfortable text. They don't find it to be as gripping or as interesting as I do. And also I think in discussions of apocalypses, which have really, I think become more and more part of, Second Temple Jewish studies, Hermas is one of those texts that also kind of falls short in those discussions as well. So I think scholars even, there's a scholar who even refers to the Shepherd as a failed apocalypse, mm-hmm. which, you know, is sort of, what a condemnation, you know. So,
exactly.
So it's a very interesting text. To work on, because modern scholars, I think, have not received or appreciated the text to the same degree that I think we might say ancient readers did. Mm-hmm. So in the ancient world, Hermas was quite popular, and it was definitely well known. We have a number of early Christian thinkers who refer to this text. And we know from Oxyrhynchus especially that there were a number of copies of the Shepherd of Hermas. In fact, a number of those manuscripts sort of rival our earliest copies of some canonical gospels. So, you know, that too is very interesting for me as a scholar. You know, why is it that modern scholars fail to appreciate this text or even to acknowledge, you know, to the same degree what ancient readers were sort of interested in. So that's sort of how I came to be interested in the Shepherd. It's an interesting first person narrative text. This is, you know, kind of in my wheelhouse. It also raises some interesting questions for people who are working on apocalypses. And so that's really been a great project. I've had a great time with Hermas and the kind of foot journey that he's been taking. The Shepherd of Hermas, you know, just to give you a little bit of mapping of this text, it's one of the lengthiest works from the category of writings that we know as, we refer to traditionally as the Apostolic Fathers, right? So if you go to the Loeb Classical Library, this is the Apostolic Fathers sort of volume. And it's divided into three parts. The first part is really what I'm interested in. So that's what I wrote on the Book of Visions, where Hermas describes in first person a series of visions. There are five. The fifth vision really sort of a bridge or segue into the following section of the mandates, which is, you know, ethical instruction. And then you have the third section called the similitudes or the parables. So all in all, you know, the Shepherd is really significant, large, you know, early Christian writing, perhaps one of the earliest texts that we might think of outside of the New Testament. And I thought it really, you know, when you read about what scholars say about the Shepherd, oftentimes I found it tended to be very sort of condensed, if that makes sense. It
Absolutely.
tended to really be engaged in conversations about the canon, which I think is also a really important topic in sort of our generation, you know, that I would say from the 90s, 80s, 90s onward, you know, people are very interested in looking at what was authoritative literature, what was canonical. These were important questions when I was in graduate school in the 90s. People also, I think scholars tended to engage the shepherd with questions of socio-historical, kind of ecclesiastical, history, so to speak. And I found that people did not really sort of answer this question, you know, about the popularity of the shepherd. And they also didn't seem to engage the shepherd on the grounds, really, the basis on which I think most early Christian thinkers actually record it as a catechetical work, right? So people, I think modern scholars, it seemed to be, I perceived this sort of disconnect between what modern scholars saw and appreciated about the shepherd and what I saw early Christian thinkers sort of acknowledging and appreciating about the shepherd. And so that's what made it a great research project. In the book, I'm really focusing just on the Book of Visions. And I kind of like gesture, I kind of gesture toward the things that followed the Book of Visions. And really, it's the mandates or kind of ethical instruction. And so that for me was important. You know, I'm very aware that as modern scholars, we tend to divide and analyze ancient writings in our own kind of disciplinary ways, you know, things that we're comfortable with or the kind of training that we happen to have. So, you know, that question, what is the really ultimately, the question for me was, what is the relationship between these visions and the text that follows, namely this ethical instruction? So the idea for the book is really to propose that modern scholars sort of are trained to read in discipline-specific ways, and that these discipline-specific ways oftentimes prevent us from seeing what ancient readers enjoyed and appreciated about this work. And so the modern scholars with the Book of Visions looking for references to historical figures, right? Or looking for some idea of what did the church look like at this time. I think that's a socio-historical aspect. And really what my project is pointing out that discipline-specific ways of reading for history or for theology or for those kinds of genre questions, that those discipline-specific approaches kind of require us to read a narrative against the grain of the text. So in order to get that information, sometimes we have to push against the narrative in a way that I don't think ancient readers did. And so the approach that I use in this book, I use a number of different approaches from cognitive literary theory, but there's one scholar whose work, and most of these people, cognitive literary theorists, oftentimes are working in these larger fields of literature. And so we don't have many who work in biblical studies. But Elfenbein, I don't know if I'm saying his name correctly or not, but you know, his point that we read, that scholars read against the grain of a narrative and they fail to enjoy what made literature enjoyable. We fail to appreciate, I should say, we fail to appreciate what made a text enjoyable to a reader in its era. And so that I think really for me, when I thought about the shepherd, I thought, yeah, that's really what I think might be happening here. And so I hope that the book helps us to see the shepherd with new eyes. And sort of what that was one of my early titles for the book, but I think
Fell by the
people
wayside,
probably
huh?
would have, yeah. So, but anyway, so that's just sort of a long-winded, you know, explanation for where my interest in the shepherd sort of fit, how that fit into my larger sort of background in ancient Jewish prayers and apocalypses.
Oh, wonderful. That's a great introduction to all of the topics that I asked you about in the opening question. And it's absolutely a vexing book when it comes to issues of genre and expectations that we might carry into early Christian literature about quote unquote normative theology or any of the other expectations that we bring to a book like this. And I fully see how it fits in with your previous interest in apocalypses because there's a lot of revelatory activity, especially early in the Book of Visions, that we'll get into as we continue our conversation here. As I read your book, I saw a unique contribution, as you were sort of mentioning here, to the Shepherd of Hermas as the application of these cognitive literary theories, which come themselves from, modern psychological studies of reading. So you apply these to this ancient text, and that's, well reflected in your title's embodied reading of the Shepherd, as well as your discussion of an active reading and your attention to the ordinary details, perhaps, of Hermas's experiences, like his observation of the sun shining or the field of grass that he's walking in, and so on. Can you say a word about what cognitive literary theory entails for us, first of all? The different elements that you bring into the book and how all this conspires to, I think, as you say, activate readers' minds to participate in the narrative of the story world of a book like The Shepherd.
Okay, so I've been interested in cognitive approaches because I feel that they offer a way to integrate different aspects of what it is to be a flesh and blood reader of an ancient text. And the type of approach that I use is relies on an understanding of cognition that we call enactivism, which goes back to something from the early 90s about the embodied mind. And so it really refers to a much broader kind of perspective than just what literary theorists are taking from it. But it is a kind of alternative. Enactivism is a kind of alternative to what we think of as a representational approach. So enactivism highlights much more the constructive and participatory process of cognition and also the imagination. So my interest with it is an active reading actually does rely quite a bit on the what we understand of the cognitive process of visual perception, which makes it a nice approach for visions to look at a text that's describing different visions, like the Book of Visions. So, if I just say a little bit about that, the cognitive science of visual perception and embodied reading sort of focuses in on the common experience that we might have that when we see something, we take it in like a photograph. But for cognitive scientists who study visual perception, they would say, well, actually, your eye is focusing in on specific data points. And that what happens in our mind, in our imagination, is that we extend and complete those discrete focus points of attention in order to construct a coherent scene, like a photograph. Okay, so literary theorists take this information about what we know about those cognitive processes and extend it to the reading of narrative. The particular cognitive literary theorist that I used and I have found to be really helpful is Marco Caracciolo, who also does quite a bit of work on fantasy literature, which if you think about fantasy texts and apocalypses, they share, of course, this idea that you're talking about a landscape or experiences that are sort of out of the ordinary, that, places that nobody has seen or experiences that nobody has had before. So it was compatible in that sense. And in that approach, it's really the first person voice and sort of descriptions of the characters. Proprioception and interoception that contribute to the immersive qualities of reading narrative. So, proprioception would refer to the kind of kinesthetic language about a particular character. So, Hermas sort of walking, or Hermas's experiences of falling on his knees, any kind of reference to the extended body moving through space, or a kind of interacting with his environment. You know, those types of references are important, and also interoceptive experiences, which are, you know, referred to sort of interior experiences that, if you think about the skin and viscera, those types of experiences that are both expressed and also experiences that are taken in through the skin and viscera. So things like emotions, but also expressions of emotions like goosebumps or blushing or sweating or trembling.
Mm-hmm.
Or weeping, you know, those types of experiences are interoceptive. That these are proprioception and interoceptive details are what contribute to a reader's sort of, a reader being able to access that narrative world and to sort of find it to be a kind of immersive experience. Does that make sense? And I think with Hermas,
yeah.
we do get quite a bit about his anxiety, his worry. He talks about, his trembling, his tears, you know, things like that, that I think make the approach fitting. So.
It absolutely does make sense. And although you do, mention that a photograph is a bad way to think of memories, to use a certain metaphor, Hermas paints a picture for his readers, for his audience, that they can, you know, participate in and feel like they're in that story world, perhaps.
Yeah, he gives us these little flashpoints of what's going on. And then I think we actually, as readers, we do a lot more constructive work and sort of making a coherent scene from the details that he gives us.
Wonderful. Thinking about the shepherd and the ways that we have discussed that we know that it's popular in antiquity. I think our work, mine and yours, both share a goal of understanding the popularity of this text in antiquity. We could talk about it from multiple angles, but one go-to measure is usually its existence in manuscript copies that are dated before, you know, the 4th century, before Christianity becomes somewhat theologically normalized under the impetus of the Roman emperors, and other factors as well. But on my reading of your book, I think you see its popularity as relating to the ways that, for one, Hermas sort of grips readers into an entertaining narrative world. And then number two, also he gives voice to sort of common emotional states that all human beings have, such as unrequited love or lust or grief. And for a third, he kind of offers this not threatening and in fact a socially comforting view on the place and demeanor and how someone would behave if they're a manumitted slave in the Roman world, as Hermas claims to be. Can you give examples of these different factors playing into the shepherd's popularity, and also any that I missed from your book in this brief recap?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a big question.
Yes.
The gripping sort of narrative. Well, I think it's just sort of there. I would just say if you read through the Book of Visions, there are places where Hermas comes across as sort of a vulnerable person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a scene where he takes a seat. You know, and the lady in the vision says, no, no, not there. Don't sit there. Sit here. You know, and you sort of really feel for him. Like, oh, terrible. He must be so embarrassed, at this point. And you see his temerity and his hesitation. So there are some things like that, that in some way he has this kind of servile, subservient kind of, personality that I think is engaging. And some of it is, I think, a little bit exaggerated. But there are those scenes like that which engage both motion, right? He's getting up and he's moving over, but they also engage his perhaps worry or self-consciousness, his anxiety as well, that I think help us as a reader to notice and to kind of, in some ways, empathize a little bit with what's going on. There are also places that I think are humorous in the Book of Visions that I think, modern scholars tend not to appreciate the humor or the exaggeration in those passages. For example, in the vision of the beast, which, I think, the tendency for people who work in apocalypses is, of course, to think of a beast as something large and terrifying. But this particular beast, I think, is described in such a way as to highlight how it really can't possibly do any physical harm to a person. It's described as a sea creature, but of course, it's on this it's on the road, a kind of
Right.
dusty road, by the way. So it's not just any road, but it's like a dust, really dry road. And the sun is really hot, right? So all of the things that would dry out a sea creature, of course. And his mouth is open and his tongue is hanging out. And there are also these flies coming out of his mouth. So it's a huge, I mean, it's an enormous monster, enormous beast. But the way it's described, I think, is intended to, it sort of exaggerates how it's not really going to do anyone any harm. Or immediate harm, but we see Hermas is sort of deeply worried, of course, as you should be, by what he sees. And the woman that he encounters, a different woman in this scene, sort of asking him in a, did you see anything on the way
Right.
over here?
Right.
It is sort of, and of course he talks about the terror that he experiences and so on and so forth. So for example, that kind of scene, clearly the she imparts, and gives a kind of revelatory type of account. But in the book, I talk about how scholars tended to read her speech and read the beast in light of that, and that scholars would actually sort of take this as a scary moment, but I think actually it's supposed to be humorous, a humorous.
The way that you describe it gives sort of a children's literature quality to it. The way that the woman speaks almost in like a teacherly voice. What did you see and what happened and so on and so forth. And it could be read almost as a parody of an idea that there's a beast that's able to harm someone because Hermes just walks right by it, protected of course by the angel Thegri, I believe.
Yes, the Greek. That's right. So these are, yeah, those are, I think it's just, it's a kind of sort of humorous moment. Yeah, and I think scholars tend to overlook that. The scene closes, book four, I mean, the vision in book four closes with exactly these words. I turned around out of fear, thinking that the beast was coming. So it sort of closes with this sort of image of Hermas is still to his core, expressing those servile tendencies of, lacking courage and fortitude. So,
It's
but
a poor
yeah, I think it's entertaining. It's supposed to be entertaining.
It is, and it's also important to highlight the details as you do. I think that when we read the Shepherd, we want to get through it. It's a long book. We want to get to, the meat and potatoes, and we bypass these very interesting details. So you do a great job at exploring that in your book. I also observed in your book how many times you categorize the Shepherd as a catechetical text. That is one that's useful for preparatory instruction of newcomers to Christianity in the early centuries. And your subtitle talks about the role of the Book of Visions in moral formation as well. So I guess it was a little surprising that you didn't delve necessarily into the quality of the text's moralizing aims, as you put it, at much length. And I think at one point you even suggest that the book is not indicative of a serious genre, which I'm cu curious to hear more about. Beyond that, can you discuss the basis first for classifying this text as catechetical in nature? Where does that come from? And if you perceive that anyone commentating on the book from antiquity might have perceived it to be more serious than we might come to it today, more than catechesis. And furthermore, what kind of moral formation do you think Hermas is interested in developing within his readers and hearers?
Well, here, I think the catechetical genre of the work, you know, just comes from those early Christian references to the shepherd, that they're aware of it, that it's, you know, useful for instruction, but we shouldn't use it in worship, you know, publicly, that these are just things that, you know, I think are part of how shepherd had been remembered or recognized in the ancient world. So, you know, that aspect is not something that I'm applying that reference or that I sort of created that reference, but I saw that as sort of an ancient sort of understanding of this particular work and what it was known about. That passage you talk about on page 160, here, you know, I just want to give a little bit more context for that particular passage, and I'll just sort of read from the passage itself, if that's okay.
Sure.
I just say, modern scholars often carry certain expectations about religious writings that then influence how such narrative details are appreciated. And when modern scholars read ancient apocalypses and catechetical literature as serious genres, they overlook the way in which ancient authors sought, above all, to make their writing appealing to ancient readers. And humor and exaggeration were essential components for memorable storytelling. Furthermore, these elements can create conditions in which what is seen and heard is more easily retained and remembered, an important effect for a catechetical work like The Shepherd. So that idea that modern scholars, and here this is the vision of the beast, who think of apocalypses as this a very serious genre, which, you know, I agree. This is, you know, I'm not going to look for humor in most apocalypses except for, you know, the Book of Visions here. But that the expectation that we have certain scholarly, we're certain sort of trained as scholars to think about certain genres in a particular way as serious genres, so to speak. That's what I was referring to there, where instruction, especially instruction about moral teachings or about matters that we think are serious matters, that they would somehow not have a humorous or entertaining quality to them. So I was sort of, again, it's sort of one of the themes of the book is that modern scholars, when we bring our own expectations about what a particular type of writing should look like, sometimes we tend to overlook these details that I think were important for the ancient reader.
Okay, very good. So the very beginning of The Shepherd, that would be Vision 1, is a really interesting episode. It kind of sets the, it charts the course for the rest of the book in some ways. And there's been some really important work interpreting it, both by yourself and an Italian scholar, Emanuele Castelli. But basically, the book opens by referencing the protagonist, Hermas's former enslaved status and his encounter with a woman who he sees bathing in the Tiber River in Rome. His reaction to the episode and what is revealed to him by a heavenly lady drives the narrative that follows. It, you know, informs him of his own sin in this situation, and, you know, causes him to reckon with how he could possibly be saved in this, in light of his subconscious sin. Can you delve into this passage a little bit for us as it appears in The Shepherd for our listeners? And especially maybe appealing to your interoceptive reading of Hermas's emotional state, sort of the details that he recognizes, and explain how you bring in the Roman sculptures of Venus, which I thought was a really interesting way to make this scene even more vivid for us. And any analogous scenes from Jewish and Roman texts of women bathing and forbidden viewing, as it were.
Yeah, so the book opens with this really tantalizing image. It's so brief, and it's very memorable, of course, because it's sort of a literary trope that we see recurring in not just Jewish writings, but also in other, you know, classical writings. So this idea that Hermas sees a woman bathing in the Tiber River, he actually gives her right, his hand to help her come out of the river. And it says, when I observed her beauty, I began thinking in my heart, or reasoning in my heart, quote, I would be fortunate to have a wife of such beauty and character, end quote. This is all I had in mind, nothing else.
Nothing
You
more,
really
right?
have this, you really have this sense that he's sort of denying something here,
Exactly,
even at the
yes.
very beginning. And so this scene, I think, especially is one that is a good, is a great example of how mod, you know, this sort of inactive reading, the kind of participatory but also highly constructive reading process that we go through. Because I think, you know, we have these really fragmentary details about what happened there at the river. Notice Hermas is talking in the first person voice. He talks about the proprioception, his own bodily movement. He makes contact with her by extending his hand. And then we have these sort of interior kind of thoughts. But modern scholars, I think, you know, see these fragments or these details, and they extended and completed this scene based on what they know of their own modern world and how women should behave in the modern world. A good Christian woman, for example. So, this question, Martin Leutsch, you know, sort of is quite critical of this scene. What self-respecting woman would allow a man who is not her husband to help her come out of the water in that way? And this is a kind of a view that is repeated, you know, I think among modern scholars. So it sort of illustrates that sort of process that we go through as readers, that we extend and complete what we know of a woman, who what she should or should not do in such a scenario. What I propose is that, well, when we try to think about what would an ancient reader, how might they extend and complete this scene? You know, all we have is really a naked woman bathing in an open body of water, and that you have Hermas sort of there, being able to see everything, right? Being able to see what's going on. So, you know, I propose that perhaps what we should be thinking is some of those commonplace images of women bathing that would have been all over the Roman world, you know, images of Venus bathing, which would have been there in the bathhouses, but also just as part of the sort of typical statuary for the Roman Empire. And of course, we know that such statues were commonplace, but that they also aroused desire, right? So we have classical writings that speak about this. You know, Ovid, of course, talks about how statues can, you know, give a very elaborate and, you know, the whole narrative, of course, with the statue of the goddess in his Metamorphosis. You know, they're all just it, there are many, many places where statuary, the provocative poses of the statues, I think maybe the kind of image that an ancient reader would have on a day-to-day basis encountered or associated with this kind of scene in the Tiber River, right, with Rome. Tiber, of course, is reference to Rome. So that's sort of what I propose that, and again, you know, the idea is that embodied reading, I'm not just talking about ancient readers. I'm really critiquing how modern readers take these details, and they sort of supply the gaps with their own assumptions about how the world works or what's acceptable or unacceptable. And so that example, I think, highlights, you know, the very different types of maybe ordinary experiences that we might imagine an ancient reader associating with Rome.
These are
I hope
important
that
questions
that's.
that important questions that you bring up about how we read these texts and who do we judge and how do we, and what do we imagine from them to have been historical or not. And that brings me to my next question, because we've been talking about Hermas pretty much so far as if he was a real person. However, you kind of eschew that in certain cases in your book. So you say, for example, that there is no Hermas apart from the one who is enacted by the reader and constructed mm-hmm. in his or her imagination, which I think is sort of an appeal to reader response criticism, literary criticism, for perhaps. But in the context of ancient readers and hearers, I wonder, for example, if we have any examples of people understanding Hermas or his narrative as a, you know, a fictional vision. Is he giving an entertaining episode, or did they understand this to have happened? And you also point out that Hermas, with his you know, his expressions of servile qualities and his emotions, doesn't exactly meet the expected traits for the masculine Roman man, the sensibilities that they have about masculinity in ancient Rome. I wonder, talking about fiction versus history, what happened? Could this odd combination of factors that play into this person, Hermas, suggest the preservation of an actual person's idiosyncrasies rather than sort of strategic posturing to increase the reception of this book or the entertaining value of this book?
Well, I think, you know, again, that's sort of that historical question. That's the kind of disciplinary specific question, right, that drives a lot of biblical scholars. Mm-hmm. And so I know that that's an important question for people. For me, it's not a question that I think we can answer from the Book of mm-hmm. Visions, you know, and Hermas is only mentioned in the Book of Visions.
Right.
So for, in my view, I'm a little bit less optimistic that the reference and the descriptions of this individual can be used to construct a historical figure. I do think I just don't think we have enough data. We just mm-hmm. don't have, based on this text, what we need to sort of say that this was a historical figure and that he had these experiences as they're described here in this narrative. So mm-hmm. so I focus in my study really more, you know, that, again, part of that inactivism, that we are mm-hmm. constructing the narrative world by extending and completing these details in our imagination. And the same goes for the character. So the idea that characters, in some ways, we read about Hermas certainly as a character, as we might think about encountering a historical person, like I meet you, Rob, and mm-hmm. I can see you, and I have a sense of who you are as a person. But actually, with the narrative, we know even more than we would if we were just merely encountering a historical person, right? We actually know what Hermas wrestles with, mm-hmm. his anxiety, his struggles deep within, right? So we're sort of still that omniscient reader in some ways, right? As we read this text, it's a little bit different from encountering a historical figure. Although I do think that the way in which the story gives us, again, those detailed, references to his proprioception, his interoception, that it contributes to the vividness of who mm-hmm. this figure is. So I do think that, rhetorically speaking, that the character of Hermas is, you know, I would say vividly presented, mm-hmm. but I tend to see it also as more, a little bit more exaggerated in the presentation as well. So, you know, it kind of goes back to even what Streeter noticed about Hermas being this kind of, white rabbit type figure, which, you know, is a great, great quote. You know, we might say it's unfair to yeah. Hermas in some ways, because perhaps we don't like that, but it's not just something that I would say I observe, these exaggerated details about Hermas's personality, but that other people have also noticed about Hermas. So I think that question of history, I just don't think For me, I just don't think I have the evidence to point to that based on this text.
I fully
But I
understand.
know that I know a lot of people are interested in that,
And
so.
the church has perhaps consciously forgotten this person, Hermas, and there's been attempts to reconstruct him as a historical person, perhaps a rival of Clement in early Rome. We'll bypass any other discussion of Hermas as a historical person, because however we try to understand this person existing in history, there's no doubt that he records some unique visions, such as the tower in Vision 3 and the great beast that we already talked about in Vision 4. You call attention to many details that are outside of the meat and potatoes of these visions that, conspire to bring the vividness to life for readers and hearers. For the vision of the tower, for example, which is sort of a portrait of salvation, you want to be included in this tower when the end comes, to as a sign that you are among the saved. What have we missed about the vision of the tower when we focus on offering sort of the theological interpretation of it, the angels and so on? What is so significant about the journey to the tower that Hermas spends sort of an inordinate amount of time on at the opening of Vision 3? And do you see any connection from this to later genres of, tours of heaven and hell that are so common to pseudepigraphal literature?
Okay, so well, the tower I think is really a key vision, right, for the Book of Visions, and what I focus is not so much the tower, although I think the stones are very vividly presented, and there's a lot of kinesthetic description there. But what I focus on in my discussion is really more the tedious details
Yes.
building up to the tower. Exactly the things that most, scholars tend to ignore, or they, of course, notice it and they describe, and it sort of leads to their assessment that the Shepherd is a monotonous and boring text, So, but really, for me, when I saw some of those, what I would call assessments of the literary quality of the Shepherd, as being boring or monotonous or tedious, I thought immediately of this kind of scene. And I wondered why would an ancient author take the time to include this? The work is so lengthy, why would this be part of the, why would this, have such a significant, get so much airtime, so to speak, before this tower, which is what really what I think most people, most readers are probably interested in. So I think it is about sort of generating those predispositions within the reader of watchfulness. These are things that, again, the story of the Book of Visions is about a foot journey. And just as you walk through a space that you haven't walked through before, you're sort of highly aware of the things that you might see, the surprises or the encounters that might happen along the way. So, the elaborate sort of description of this nighttime, very, very lengthy watching and waiting. This is what Hermas is doing. And in some ways, the story is told in a way that sort of recreates or simulates that anticipation, that watchfulness within the reader. And cultivating those that kind of experience of watchfulness, I think, is something that we should appreciate more in apocalypses, in general. Like, how is it that you build up, and you get the reader to pay attention? And they're sort of doing it here in Vision number three with the ivory couch, the darkness in the field. They sort of do that in real time, I would say. What does it matter that this ivory, is the ivory couch, is this going to play a key role in this? It doesn't seem to. It
Right.
just seems to be, again, something just like if you're walking on an actual foot journey, you pay attention to things that you might see, you're curious about them, and you have this little diversion, but it's really kind of contributing to the protractedness of this particular episode. And so in my book, I really think, I propose that this is something that is a kind of experiential effect of the way the narrative is written, that the author in some ways has this very extended and very slow kind of field narrative, journey narrative, nighttime journey narrative, in order to really heighten anticipation, but also to heighten that quality or aspect of watchfulness in the reader, in the person who might be hearing the text, but definitely to cultivate those sort of readerly dispositions, I would say. I would call them readerly dispositions. Even
Okay.
if you're hearing the text, I think it's still that kind of type of experience.
Very nice. There's a lot of buildup
Build up,
in
yes.
the third vision that
Yeah.
it kind of reaches a climax when you get to the tower and you get the explanation of what the stones represent and why there are certain stones that don't fit in it and how Hermes fits into that whole discussion with the woman.
Yeah. And I think in the field too, you have, Hermes talks about his interoception, right? He says he's seized with trembling, his hair stood on end, he's terrified, he's alone. He collapses on his knees and he starts praying. So, it's very much, you get this real sense of his interior sort of state through those types of details. So,
Absolutely.
anyway.
Your last chapter, Angela, attends to the difficulty of genre categorization when it comes
Yes.
to the shepherd. Obviously, one of the vexing questions that we mentioned before. This book has most of the hallmarks of the sort of classical definition of apocalyptic literature by John Jay Collins from the 1970s, I believe, is where that comes from. And he's recently updated it as well. But yet, the shepherd is typically characterized as missing out on certain distinctions or dimensions of apocalypticism, such as like the idea of this world versus an other world to come. And that we, might know famously from the canonical Revelation and its hymns and heavenly visions. Do you personally, as a scholar, consider The Shepherd an apocalyptic text and why? And how have you proposed that we handle the scholarly necessity of genre classification when it comes to a text like this to be more inclusive of different varieties of visionary texts from antiquity?
Yeah, so I think this is an important question for scholars like me who come at, because I precisely because my interest was apocalypse is still, apocalypses and what do we do with texts like Hermas, that don't fit into our modern expectations. So the definition is by John Collins is so often cited, and his work is really so foundational and so important for how we think about apocalypses. I'll just read it. Collins's Semeia discussion from 1979. Quote, "Apocalypse is a genre of revelatory literature with a narrative framework in which a revelation is mediated by an otherworldly being to a human recipient, disclosing a transcendent reality which is both temporal insofar as it envisages eschatological salvation and spatial insofar as it involves another supernatural world," end quote. So this definition, I think it was huge. Like for most of biblical scholarship, people were not even looking at apocalypses. They were sort of an awkward genre. It was really with, I think, the work of scholars like John Collins and Adela Collins, that they really became, and of course, the growing, increasing interest in Second Temple studies, where apocalypses really started to get more and more attention. And so we really have a great debt to these scholars and for trying to, create that foundation for our later discussions. Some of the things that I find about the idea of how scholars categorize apocalypses is, I think, and Collins, I think, also points out that these are scholarly designations. These are not internal, right, to the ancient understanding of the genre, but these are later modern scholarly tools that we use to analyze this very broad type of literature. So it's a modern construction service to scholars at the academy. is that I think it tends to highlight this kind of segregation of our world and the supernatural world. And I think Hermas, in some ways, because that's a part of the definition, I think that aspect of the definition, I think, says more about us as modern scholars than it does to help us understand a text like Hermas, the Shepherd, the Book of Visions. And that, it's the case that I think that this desire to highlight that movement from the here, which is this world, out into the other world, right? Like we have with many heavenly journey texts or journeys to the other place, right? But the highlighting is always that we leave our present place. I don't know. I've kind of wondered if this is sort of rooted in, our own kind of desire to explore other realms that we have in the 20th century, that's a huge cultural marker of our century, of the 20th century, is this desire to explore these new spaces, and that we perhaps are overemphasizing that movement, right, of leaving our space. The Shepherd, I think, because the visions take place, it has these other features I think are very similar. Maybe not the seriousness. Again, I go back to that term. It doesn't have that kind of serious quality, but it does enjoy other literary features that I think, apocalypses share. And so I think we should still include it in our discussion of apocalypses because, it's talking about those visionary experiences. I'm trying to remember what else. I would say I do consider it an apocalyptic text. I think it's interesting. I would say we should be more critical of our scholarly desire to compartmentalize and to
Exactly.
segregate our
Yes.
world from the supernatural world. And there are all sorts of things, like our modern academic desire to have these pure systems that, of course, in this world, we have an expectation that it's a pure system in which there is no supernatural involvement. But here, the shepherd's experiences is exactly the opposite, right? It
Yes,
sort
indeed.
of underscores how, this world that we live in, the ordinary world, we actually do have those heavenly encounters and that they take place on a foot journey, which is, again, very grounded in this world. So
Right.
in that sense, it's a lot more like Luke 24, so that last scene in the
The
Gospel of
road to
Luke, I
Emmaus,
think.
yes.
Yeah, or scenes like I was kind of thinking about Jim Kugel's discussion of A Moment of Confusion. Where he says the biblical text, he's talking about the Hebrew Bible, sort of fades in and out. And you see that the person who's having the vision is at first confused about, well, what's happening, right? Is it just a smoke, or is there actually some kind of encounter that's taking place? So that I thought like Kugel's description, I thought, well, that kind of biblical idea of encountering a figure is one that doesn't rely on that otherworldly, sort of compartmentalized space. And so I found it to be a little bit more useful. And I also think the inactive approach in which the descriptive term is not so much this worldly, otherworldly, but the descriptive term is really more the narrative world. And so, I'm more in favor of kind of shifting into that type of kind of category, if that makes sense,
Yes.
for how.
Now, I personally haven't done nearly the work on genre that you have, so I definitely sat up and took notice to this chapter. I think I'll use it in the future. But I think that the canonical revelation has, you know, held a little bit too much of a sway for how we view apocalypses. Like that has is some way in some way normative for us, that we need to have all the elements of, you know, the last book of the New Testament for it to be sort of an authentic apocalypse. But instead, in the Book of Visions, as you note, Hermas's kind of authority comes entirely from the visions that he receives and that he can report for the benefit of his family, community, and, you know, others. So I'm with you that it should be categorized within apocalypse, and we should broaden our definitional standards, perhaps. Angela, this has been a great conversation. It's been wonderful to talk to you. And I'm wondering, even though we've talked for about an hour or so, if there's anything that we've missed in this discussion that you wanted to emphasize from the long process that it is to prepare and write a book like this. Was there anything that was very surprising to you that you encountered in your research and writing process, or anything else that you want to mention from your book that is important to bring to readers or our listeners' attention?
Yeah, well, I enjoyed working on the Shabbat of Hermas, and I hope people will take a good close look at the text. I think perhaps what was surprising to me was just seeing how modern scholars tended to sort of describe it as monotonous and, mm-hmm. you know, and boring, you know, and yet they would write a 900-page commentary, you know, and I kind of made me think, wow, what is it that moves us or pushes us in our disciplinary habits to, you know, to write 900 pages. I think it's Brock's, you know, yes. to write a significant commentary like that, you know, on a work that we're not engaged by. So it's sort of, that was surprising to me that, you know, I would hope that our work would be more stimulating to ourselves personally. I don't know if that's the kind of, obviously the stimulation for that particular scholar, I think it lay somewhere else, you mm-hmm. know, besides the text itself. But I think that's probably what was most surprising, was to see how really striking that mm-hmm. difference was between how modern scholars might look at a particular text, and to see how ancient scholars, ancient readers, ancient people, how they maybe appreciated and enjoyed a text for totally different reasons. Mm-hmm. So I hope that people will take a second look. I hope modern readers will take a second look at The Shepherd and try to read it on its own terms. I did a lot of work on The Shepherd during the pandemic, where you had a lot of time on your own.
Yeah.
But also during, you know, Black Lives Matter, when it was clear that different people, based on their, you know, cultural context, saw the same thing quite differently, right? And because we saw how the country became very polarized during that time. And so, again, that idea... the approach and active reading made a lot of sense to me, that, you know, we bring our own experiences to how we fill in the gaps of what happened in this particular encounter. And that perhaps we're doing that when we read texts, mm-hmm. you know, seems like a very likely thing as well.
Indeed. Well, you bring up the comments of Streeter, you know, an early 20th century scholar, and I took note of the translator in the Anti-Nicene Fathers volume, who also is kind of repulsed by the book, even though he's just translated the whole thing for us. But there are even modern scholars who carry on this sort of derisive way of referring to the Shepherd. So that's why it's so thrilling to speak to someone who is entertained and interested in the appeal of this text. So I'm very glad to have read your book, and I hope that listeners will come to it as well.
Yeah, and as a closing thought, is it okay if I just make a little mention of other works that are coming out on The Shepherd?
Of course, go for it.
I wanted to say there's a volume published by De Gruyter Press called Experiencing the Shepherd of Hermas, edited by me and my friend and colleague Harry Meyer. Here we have a number of different essays throughout the volume that are really trying to look at the shepherd with new eyes. And so I hope readers who are interested in the shepherd would also take a look at that volume. It's published in 2022 in the Ecstasis series by
Oh,
DeGroote.
wonderful, wonderful. Out of curiosity, Angela, are you continuing to work on the Shepherd, or where have you turned your attention after the publication of your most recent book?
Well, now I'm working on a project on apocalypses as immersive narratives. So,
Okay.
looking at some of the using the method of embodied reading to think about how the immersive quality of apocalypses can help us to understand their generative power, you know, and the way in which the apocalypses, the people not only did they extend and construct the details that they see in apocalypses to construct a coherent scene, but that they also wanted to continue some of those narratives, and perhaps this led to the generation of new texts about these scenes or about these characters.
So I imagine at the very least you'll be appealing to your work on the Shepherd and how it
Yes.
is, you know, an immersive narrative and it
Yeah, yes,
generates
definitely.
an entertaining value for its readers. Well, that's
Yes.
excellent. Angela Kim Harkins, thank you for being our guest on the New Books Network today. It's been a real pleasure to speak with you about Hermas's visions and so many other things.
Thank you so much, Rob. It's great to be here.
Wonderful. Again, Dr.
Take care.
Harkins' book is An Embodied Reading of the Shepherd of Hermas, with a subtitle, The Book of Visions and Its Role in Moral Formation, available now from Equinox Books. I've been Rob Heaton for New Books in Biblical Studies, your host in New Testament and Early Christian Studies. I'll be with you again on your next download, but in the meantime, never stop questioning. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.